Then I'm going to call this meeting of the Ocean Protection Council to order. I'm going to do something slightly different. Rather than just sort of have a roll call, I'll have everybody introduce themselves, their name, and sort of how they're on the council. Start with Michael.
Michael Brown, a public member, and I've been on the council, I think, for 4 years.
Hi, Mark Stone, Assembly Member. I'm here as the Speaker's appointee.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Lucchesi. I'm the Executive Officer of the State Lands Commission, and I'm the alternate for the Lieutenant Governor.
And John Laird, Secretary of Resources.
Bill Craven, I'm Senate staff. I'm here as a designee for Senator Robert Hertzberg.
Great. Well, welcome, everybody. We are expecting Secretary Rodriguez, so he'll be here soon. I thought I would make just a few opening comments that are updates so people can be up to date on some of the issues that aren't on the agenda, because we do have a rather action-packed agenda, and some of the current events, such as the offshore oil, are on the agenda, and normally I might talk about them right now. And here, knowing how to make an entrance, is the Secretary of the Environmental Protection Agency, Matt Rodriguez. The first thing I wanted to mention is the Safeguarding California plan has been released, and that is basically the state's plan and roadmap for current and future agency activities and strategies with regard to resilience and adaptation. You can get it through the Natural Resources website. I did ask them this morning, I don't know if it's been done yet, to move it to the top level. If it's not there, you can find it, but I wanted it to be easy for people to find. And as we still deal with above average temperatures, destructive fires, higher sea levels, extreme precipitation events, the plan lays out 69 recommendations across 11 sectors or subject matter areas and more than 1,000 ongoing actions and next steps developed by scientific and policy efforts across 38 state agencies. There's an interesting section in the executive summary right at the beginning that states what the plan is and what the plan isn't, so that people can understand clearly what the guidance means and how it is not a direct mandate on certain people, but it is the guidance. And I think that's where we are right now, and that was the direction. So that's what's embodied in the plan. There is an ocean and coast chapter of the plan, and it was led by the Ocean Protection Council staff, highlights many of the existing and planned efforts to address climate impacts on marine and coastal resources. So that is one, and I know that there will be different ways that it floats out, and there's meetings and other things on how the next steps are taken, but I wanted to call attention to that. I also wanted to call attention to the release of the report on submerged aquatic vegetation and a legislative hearing that is scheduled to present the findings. And this really is part of the significant progress that's been made in implementing recommendations on the West Coast acidification and hypoxia panel and the resulting legislation, which was SB 1363. And so OPC, with other relevant agencies, was tasked with administering an ocean acidification reduction program. And so to begin this, there'll be a working group of the Ocean Protection Council Science Advisory Team in early 2017. Yesterday, the working group released the final report. Key findings and next steps from the report will be presented on February 6th from 2 to 4 p.m. at a hearing of the Assembly's Select Committee on Coastal Protection and Access to Natural Resources that just happens to be chaired by Assembly Member Mark Stone, who's sitting two seats over here, and he may have things he wishes to add just as a report when I ask if there are any other member comments. And I will be joining him along with Deborah, Karina Nielsen, and the co-chairs of the working group, Jay Stakowitz as well, and look forward to hearing more about the efforts to understand the contribution of submerged aquatic vegetation to minimizing the acidic conditions. There's also an upcoming joint committee hearing on waste management and water quality, and that ties into the ocean litter strategy. The strategy is going to come before the council for consideration at its April meeting. As part of the update, OPC staff has been coordinating with agency partners on related initiatives, and the OPC staff will continue to work with Assemblymember Stone and Assemblymember McCarty, chair of the Waste Reduction and Recycling Committee, to develop the agenda and intended outcomes of this hearing. I also wanted to just make a note under announcements that supposedly Mike Weber is actually retiring. I think there have been some false starts or there have been some reductions, but he's retiring after several decades of work promoting sustainable fisheries and the protection of marine ecosystems in California. And for the last 10 years, he's worked for the Resources Legacy Fund, providing strategic advice and leadership for their oceans, coast, and fisheries programs. But he really was instrumental in efforts regarding the Marine Life Protection Act and just what it took to implement it, move ahead with the designations. He's also been a vice president at the Center for Marine Conservation, which is now the Ocean Conservancy. And I could go on at length. He even worked as a special assistant to the director of the National Marine Fisheries Service in the Department of Commerce. And he co-authored both the first and recently released second edition of California's Guide to Marine Life Management Act. And I know we had an electronic version that was distributed to our members. And I was present where at a board meeting of the Monterey Bay Aquarium, he was surprised with an award. And he was genuinely surprised. I think he was on the verge of being speechless. And I just don't think there can be enough recognition for his role as this has moved along. And he's going to continue to work as an advisor to RLF on a part-time basis. That's my comment about false starts and supposed retirements. But I really wish him well in his next chapter of life and just want to thank him and acknowledge him for his amazing contribution to marine conservation in California. And just before I ask other members if they have any opening comments or reports, I wanted to do a few housekeeping items. We're going to move up the one consent item on the agenda so that it'll be after item 3. There appears to be not much dissent, and in case anybody has to leave, I thought it was hazardous that it was near the end of the agenda. So we will move that up after item 3. That's I think now item 9. And then we will take public comment after items 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, and allow for comment on non-agenda items. At the back of the room, you'll find speaker cards. Fill it out if you wish to speak. There's a basket here in the front of the room, and then they will bring it to me. Public comment is limited to 3 minutes each. The light on the podium will turn from green to yellow to red. And as other people know, there might be other mechanical operations that happen anywhere near the podium if you go too far over the 3 minutes. with that, let me ask if any other members have opening comments. Yes, Michael.
Thank you, Secretary Laird. I live in Santa Barbara, and you are all aware of what occurred about 3 weeks ago at this point, and with the mudslides following the Thomas Fire. I just wanted to make a comment. While there isn't apparently, you can't draw a direct correlation with the impacts of climate change, on the intensity of those mudslides. The notion of climate change affecting places far away, low-lying islands in the middle of the Pacific, really hit home for all of us in California and certainly in the Santa Barbara area and particularly in Montecito. I want to note, just because it struck me, I lived through a lot of intense rainstorms, both in Santa Barbara, and I spent almost 13 years on the East Coast, and the evening of the mudslide, there was a quarter inch of rain in 15 minutes. It's an unbelievable amount that is so unusual in Southern California. May have happened in Northern California. Certainly when I lived in Santa Cruz, felt like it was happening. And that was apparently one of the major contributions to why literally mountains came down and crushed Montecito. And so far, we've lost 21 lives. California is a leader on climate change, and the significance of doing something sooner rather than later and not ignoring it and not calling it fake news and not waiting for somebody else to make changes just really has hit home. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your heartfelt comments. Any other opening reports? Mr. Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since you queued me up, I will mention the Select Committee, which is next Tuesday at 2 o'clock in room 437 in the legislature. And this is one of the hearings where we're hoping to bring the work that's being done at OPC and a number of different agencies into the legislature to talk about. And, Mr. Brown, as you mentioned, the really lack of understanding of effects of climate change, especially in other parts of this country, that or lack of acceptance of the consequences. And California's been a leader on setting policies that mitigate the greenhouse gas emissions. But what we really haven't tackled is setting California up to address the effects of the changing climate and the things that we are going to see with fires, floods, lots of other things that are going to happen, and to build a resilient California to actually adapt to what's happening is important. And that's why this committee hearing, I think, is so important to bring some of this work into the legislative context as we search for policy solutions to address the changes that are happening. The ocean's changing. The chemistry's changing. We're seeing some significant impacts to our ecosystems across the state and not quite knowing what to do about it. The bringing science into policymaking is going to be increasingly important if we're going to be able to start to have some of the answers to those questions and start to understand what it is we should be doing and could be doing to build a stronger California for the future so we don't have the fires, so we don't have some of the catastrophic effects that unfortunately we would otherwise see. So I'm excited about hosting OPC and having that information brought into the legislative context, and I hope that will lead to stronger policy. We're good at directing executive departments to do things to study this and study that, but there are a lot of hard decisions that are going to need to be made, both in the legislative context and the executive context, in order to build a stronger California. And I'm hoping that we can work together and do exactly that. So thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Any other reports or opening comments? Then seeing none, we'll move to item number 2, which is a report from the Executive Director.
Thank you, Secretary Laird. And thank you, council members. I am feeling really more excited and energized about OPC's work than ever before. I think that we are doing phenomenal cross-cutting work in every program area and every portfolio across all the staff, and we are teeing up so many important projects. So just next week, we're going to be hosting a webinar through the California Coastal Resilience Network to discuss our sea level rise guidance document. So in that, we'll be highlighting the themes that ran throughout all of the public comments that we received so far on our draft document, and we'll be explaining how we are integrating those comments and responding to those comments, and we'll also be talking about next steps that need to be taken following adoption of the guidance, because our work on sea level rise does not end at all with adoption of a guidance document. Now we really need to think about how it's going to be implemented, how it's going to be taken up by the local governments and state agencies, what we need to do to make it accessible and real. And we'll be bringing that guidance document to you on March 14th. Next week also, we, as Secretary Laird and Assemblyman Stone so eloquently described, we will be having a hearing on submerged aquatic vegetation. And that is an opportunity for us to discuss the ability of seagrasses and kelp to both ameliorate ocean acidification and its potential for sequestering carbon. So it's kind of a mitigation-adaptation combo, which is pretty exciting. And in fact, KQED just released yesterday a podcast describing the impacts of climate change and ocean acidification on the ecosystem and the potential for seagrass to act as a buffer. That was the report that they cited was based on research that this council funded. So that was great. Also next week, that's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we'll be speaking in opposition to BOEM's proposal to open up California's coast to offshore oil and gas drilling, which is another agenda item today. So in addition to what we've got going on just next week.
And you're just presuming the outcome of that item, right?
I'm sorry, you're right. You're right.
I don't think you're off base, but it is, yes, a presumption at this point. Yeah.
Point taken. We also recently released our draft ocean litter strategy for public comment, and the revised draft strategy includes a section specifically on OPC's priorities to address ocean litter, as well as statewide stakeholder goals and objectives and actions. And so broadly speaking, OPC's priorities can be divided into three categories. There's land-based sources of ocean litter, microplastics and microfibers, and ocean and fishing and aquaculture gear. So those are the kind of our three areas that we are intending to focus most of our effort on, and our draft strategy outlines our goals and our objectives and our policy implementation options for those. And comments for the draft litter strategy for the public who are watching, they're due February 23rd. On the wind energy front, we've been working very closely with the California Energy Commission on the issue of marine renewable energy. And OPC, the CEC, and BOEM have met with local elected officials, with fishermen, with scientists, with tribes, with environmental groups, with the maritime industry, to understand the various perspectives on offshore wind. And the OPC's Marine Renewable Energy Working Group will be co-hosting a workshop on marine renewable energy on March 13th. We recently released our competitive grant solicitations for both Prop 1 and Prop 84, and we've been conducting extensive public outreach. On Prop 1, we had five public outreach efforts, and we've completed four of them. So Marina Cazorla has been traveling up and down the state talking to people about Prop 1. Prop 84, also we released that competitive grant solicitation that you approved a couple of meetings ago, authorizing $7 million in competitive grants. And proposals for Prop 1 projects are due February 23rd. Proposals for Prop 84 projects are due March 15th. So we will be rolling with all of those as well. A couple of weeks ago, OPC staff representing the MPA leadership team participated in a panel discussion at the MPA Federal Advisory Committee in San Francisco and gave a presentation on California's MPA management program. And we received really positive feedback. The presentation and the panel discussion were very well received, and the Federal Advisory Committee indicated interest in increasing its coordination with California to highlight our unique and valuable approach to MPA management. At the beginning of January, we also reconvened the California Dungeness Crab Fishing Gear Working Group, which is a very long title. But the goal of that working group is to support both a thriving whale population and a profitable Dungeness crab fishery off of our coast. And together, this working group developed a draft risk assessment and mitigation program. And the idea here is that the experts in this area, the fishermen, the researchers, the NGOs, could identify and assess elevated levels of whale entanglement risk and determine the need for different management options to reduce any risk of entanglement. And so that working group is currently piloting a program for this season, this year's season, for Dungeness crab. And I think it's a really exciting moment for noting how these different groups are coming together to work for the benefit of both the ecosystem and the fishery, and it really is a valuable model for how we can adaptively manage fisheries, particularly in light of climate change and changing ocean conditions. And we've received very positive feedback on that effort. And last but not least, because of all of the amazing work that's going on, we are staffing up. And I am very pleased to announce several additions to our already stellar climate change team. So first we have Whitney Berry is our newest Sea Grant Fellow. You want to stand up, Whitney? Hi. She started yesterday. And she earned her MA in International Environmental Policy, concentrating in ocean and coastal resource management. Most recently, she worked with the IUCN's Global Marine and Polar Program, focusing her time on the research of deep seabed mining in areas beyond national jurisdiction and its potential impacts on the overall health of the ocean. So she'll be working with us across our climate change program, including sea level rise, ocean acidification, and changing ocean conditions. Sarah Briley, who up until yesterday was our Sea Grant Climate Fellow, is going to continue to work with us through mid-May to support our work on regional ocean acidification, monitoring, and data management. And she's been a real key player in that area and has helped develop some really impactful mapping tools that the scientists in the field are very excited about. And then finally, we are really excited to welcome Tinya Huang. Tinya will be beginning on February 26th as an environmental scientist in our climate change program, and she comes to us from BCDC, where she developed great expertise in the area of sea level rise, and so we are looking really forward to having her help us in those next steps that I talked about in terms of implementing the guidance, as well as thinking through what else do we need to be doing in terms of resilience and adaptation, as Assemblyman Stone mentioned. And Tinya has worked for, as I said, the BCDC. She worked for California Coastal Commission. She has a master's degree in environmental science and management from the Bren School and a master's and bachelor's degree from Stanford. And one last note is a shout out for NGO friends that February 20th is Ocean Day here in Sacramento. So we will be getting lots of visits from NGOs.
Great. Thank you very much. Are there questions or comments on the executive director's report? Seeing none, then we will go to item number 3, which is a report from the science advisor.
Thank you, Secretary Laird, Deborah, council members, and OPC staff. It's my pleasure to be here today to report out from the science advisory team on our work. We have been involved, as you know, with this unique partnership, very collaborative partnership between the Ocean Protection Council, Ocean Science Trust, and the OPC Science Advisory Team. We continue to be effective in bringing what we hope is and think is relevant and timely scientific analysis and science to the state to help it adapt to climate change and to address other challenges facing our coast and ocean, California coastal communities and the economy. The partnership among the three organizations is strong, and we continue to strengthen how we operate and work together. Through our partnership and with OPC funding in 2017, we produced a portfolio of reports and guidance documents in response to state needs that is informing management and policy, including guidance on climate change and peer review to support the Department of Fish and Wildlife with their update of the master plan for fisheries. We completed an adaptive decision-making framework also for the Department of Fish and Wildlife for permitting scientific research activities within marine protected areas, the research that it may involve collecting animals or plants from those places. And we updated, as you heard earlier, the guidance on projected sea level rise that is informing states' new sea level rise policy. We have several additional efforts that are underway or on the horizon, some of which you've heard about already from Deborah, but I'll take a moment to describe a few of them in a little more detail. Before I do that, I do want to say a couple of words about the OPC Science Advisory Team vacancy that we hope will be filled after today. To identify scientists for this vacancy, the Ocean Science Trust led a public nomination process that resulted in many qualified applicants coming in to be considered. The highly qualified scientist who we are proposing you consider appointing to the science advisory team later today was put forth after thoughtful review and deliberation, considering all the nominees together with OPC leadership and the Ocean Science Trust, and with the Science Advisory Team Executive Committee. So on behalf of the Executive Committee, I just want to thank all of those who responded to the call for nominees and nominations, and especially those scientists who are willing and interested in contributing to our work. We look forward to other opportunities to collaborate in the future as we help California address policy challenges with scientific information.
I'm going to take that as the staff report on item 9 and just stipulate it when we get there, which would allow me now to ask if anybody had any questions or comments of Karina about what she just said. Okay, please continue.
Great. Thank you. The OPCSAT remains active in working to inform the state efforts to reduce the impacts of ocean acidification. As Assemblymember Stone talked about just a few minutes ago, we are about to release the Science Advisory Team Working Group on Aquatic Vegetation and Ocean Acidification's report. That was released yesterday, and it is entitled Emerging Understanding of Seagrass and Kelp as an Ocean Acidification and Management Tool in California. This report was a product of collaboration between scientists convened for the working group, OPC staff, and the Ocean Science Trust. Our goal was to gain a better understanding of how and if seagrasses and kelp might protect coastal species that are vulnerable to ocean acidification. This came out of one of the recommendations, science recommendations, made by the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel, which was also an OPC-sponsored panel. And the emerging research is indicating that the habitats that seagrasses and kelp create can create increases in seawater pH and may provide relief for some of the species that are living there. We continue to learn more about when and where we are likely to see the largest benefits, and aside from any of the carbon benefits these habitats provide, we also note that investing in protecting and restoring seagrass and kelp is basically a no-regrets strategy. There are many other benefits, and for as a coastal management strategy, it helps maintain functional, resilient ecosystems in the face of not just ocean acidification but other stressors. So there's a win-win there. I, along with the Secretary, OPC leadership, and other colleagues, will be presenting on this topic at the upcoming hearing of Assemblyman Stone's Select Committee on Coastal Protection and Access to Natural Resources on February 6th. The hearing is open to the public, and we invite people interested in this topic to join us. There's a new ocean acidification task force being formed. This is another OPC science advisory team effort on behalf of the on behalf of ocean acidification and hypoxia science task force. And anyway, it will be co-chaired by OPC science advisory team member Steve Weisberg, who I believe I saw in the room. Over there, along with the former West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Panel co-chair, Dr. Francis Chan, from Oregon State University, and it includes scientific experts from California, Oregon, Washington, federal government, and D.C. This builds on the state's investment in the original West Coast OAH panel effort in 2016, so we're excited to see that. You will hear more about this effort from Jen Phillips a little later, and we look forward to working with the council and staff members on ways we can address the challenges of ocean acidification and hypoxia. The next project I want to update you on, and Deborah already mentioned this, is the fourth climate assessment working group on a parallel track. As you likely know, California's fourth climate assessment is underway, synthesizing cutting-edge findings and the best available climate science and individual reports for 9 regions, as well as tribal and indigenous communities and environmental justice. So a number of individual reports within that assessment. For the fourth assessment, we have an active OPC science advisory team working group that's writing a chapter specifically on California's oceans and coasts. The working group is composed of leaders in both science and policy arenas, working again in partnership with the Ocean Science Trust, the OPC Science Advisory Team members. The group is developing forward-looking reports synthesizing potential impacts of climate change, specifically with that emphasis on the coast and oceans, and that's a new chapter in the report, so we're excited about that. The report really presents an opportunity to rebuild resilience in California, specifying how science can support these efforts, and we look forward to sharing the report this summer. Lastly, I want to remark on the new science advisory team effort that just started this month that will provide scientific guidance to support the development of the OPC's new Once Through Cooling Mitigation Funding Program. Responding to our charge from OPC and also in consideration of the discussion that the council had on this topic at the last meeting, the group will focus on helping the state to understand the geographic scope of impact from each particular once-through-cooling plant based on our current understanding of currents, estuaries, larval exchange, and the like. And it will examine the current scientific evidence and define what types of projects, research, or restoration can lead to increases in marine life within marine protected areas. This is one of the stated goals for how the funds are spent through the Once Through Cooling policy. We look forward to sharing that in the coming months. While we continue to face challenges with both political climate and changing climate, the OPC Science Advisory Team really looks forward to continuing to provide California with current, timely, and high-quality science and analysis to support effective policies. For fisheries management, for water quality, for marine protected areas, marine pollution, and other unexpected potential changes that may lie ahead. So we thank you for your support, and we look forward to continuing our work with you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments on the Science Advisor report? Seeing none, then we're going to move to the repositioned item 9. And item 9 is the consent item, approval of a new science advisory team member. The items are in your packet, and the presentation was just made. Nobody has brought me any cards, so I'm gathering that nobody wanted to speak on this. Are there any questions or comments or a motion from members of the council? Move the consent calendar. There's a motion.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? No. It carries unanimously. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. We're going to move to item number 4, which is an action item. It's consideration and approval of a resolution opposing new exploration and drilling for oil and gas on California's Outer Continental Shelf. I'm going to make some opening comments, turn it over to Chris. This is one I'm sure we'll have some people that want to make comments, and then we'll bring it back for comments and action to the council. I think one way to set this up is that I did a rather long interview last week with Lauren Summers of KQED for the California Report, and it was just a very interesting direction that she wanted to take. She said, you were instrumental in the local government organizing in the 1980s against offshore oil. What happened then? How does it feel to be where you are now and have this happening again? And it's interesting because there are certain times when you believe that you've won a battle and that it's over, that you don't have to constantly have to renew the fight. And in the 1980s, in Santa Cruz, we had a tradition because we had off-year elections. They weren't in the even years. You had to excite people about voting, of having ballot measures. And I approached people that were environmental activists and said, I would like to do a ballot measure on offshore oil. And I remember the meeting. We were in somebody's living room, and they said, we don't want to do it unless it has teeth. And so, you know, we were scratching our heads because we were a city. And what rights did you have with the federal and the state government really being the ones that were out front on the federal leases? And with Supervisor Gary Patton at the time in Santa Cruz and other people, we came up with the notion that you had to have a vote of the people to approve a zoning change for onshore support facilities for offshore oil drilling. And so we referended it. We put it on the ballot. We said, obviously, we oppose this. We adopt that for the city. And we authorized the appropriation of city money in case we wish to educate other cities and counties on how they might do the same thing if they were interested in doing it. So it passed with over 80% of the vote. We hired Save Our Shores to do it. By the time we were done, we had 27 cities and counties on the California coast that adopted that ordinance that are all still in place. We beat the Western Oil and Gas Association and federal court about halfway through for the right to do it, because cities have very limited constitutional powers, but the power of zoning is one. And not doing an absolute ban, but just reserving the right to the people could pass constitutional muster. Those are all still there. And there were just countless organizing efforts based on, wasn't that far from the 1967 spill at the time and impacts, but there were issues of shipping lanes and where the drilling was going, of disturbance on the ocean floor, of the fact that the statistic I used to use, not anticipating there would be a second round of Jerry Brown and climate programs, is that just approval of 1 mile per gallon in fuel efficiency standards would actually obviate the need for any of the offshore oil drilling and the amount that of energy that would be come from that. And there was also these air quality issues that weren't represented. The air quality releases from a single rig would equal something like those of 30,000 cars on a given day. And so all these impacts were real impacts that we made the fight on. And there was I'm reflected that I sit next to an outstanding secretary of the EPA, because at the time I was appointed to the governor's committee on outer continental shelf activities, and it was chaired by the secretary of EPA, and they had a meeting of committee members with the governor, but they refused to invite any members of the committee that opposed offshore oil drilling. So even though I was a member of the committee, I was not invited to meet with the committee and the governor because of my position on this, which seems kind of preposterous now that I am in this current incarnation. There was a hearing similar to the listening hearing that is coming up next week. It was in Fort Bragg, and they made the mistake of saying they would hear anybody that wanted to speak. So it went 24 hours in the Fort Bragg City Hall. They did such organizing in Mendocino County that it was half off at any bed and breakfast for anybody that came to testify. When I drove into Fort Bragg, there were little kids dressed as stars, you know, sea stars, marching into the city. It was an amazing event. And you just look back at that time. There were those of us that went to the 1988 Democratic Convention in Atlanta, and we had oil rig signs with circles and line through it, and we had an agreement that one speaker was going to mention it, and we were going to have all our signs up and be on national TV and show that there was this issue. And it was only Leon Panetta and John Van de Kamp, the attorney general, that were between us and drilling in California. And we successfully held it off till there could be a change and a moratorium that has essentially gone to this day. Now, we're much more efficient at what we do. We're much more concerned about the impacts from emissions and disturbance on the seafloor. We're much more aware of what the actual impacts are to oceans and coasts. And yet it is proposed again. And in the current climate, they're not starting with the resoluteness that was done by James Watt and Donald Hodel. They actually had a specific lease process. They had it mapped out. They were marching down the path. This is still rather vague on the mapping. We want to do it. If you're the governor of Florida, you call 3 days later and you get exempted, and which led to the governor of California requesting a call. He got a call. He expressed our opposition. He invited Secretary Zinke to come to California and meet and see it, and got the indication that he might well do that. And so now we are moving into this. And I think it is fair not to take anything for granted, to feel like we have to organize again and have to educate people and have everybody out on the line again to do that. So that is sort of where we stand right now, and I think Chris is going to present in relation to the resolution. I have a few people that want to speak, and we'll bring the matter. So let me recognize Chris Potter of the staff.
Thank you, Chairman Laird. Good afternoon, council members. So today I'll be presenting item 4 on the agenda, in case you've forgotten, resolution opposing renewed oil and gas leasing on the California Outer Continental Shelf, as proposed in the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management's 2019-2024 draft proposed OCS oil and gas leasing program. The resolution is consistent with Goal D of the OPC's strategic plan, which reads, ensure that existing and emerging uses of California's coast and ocean are planned and managed in a manner that balances their social and economic benefits with the long-term protection and sustainability of the state's marine and coastal resources. On April 28, 2017, President Trump issued an executive order called Implementing an America First Offshore Energy Strategy, which establishes a policy to encourage energy exploration and production on the Outer Continental Shelf. The U.S. Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, BOEM, followed suit earlier this month by publishing in the Federal Register a notice of availability of the 2019-2024 draft proposed Outer Continental Shelf Oil and Gas Leasing Program, aka DPP, and notice of intent to prepare a programmatic environmental impact statement. For the first time in decades, a DPP proposes oil and gas lease sales in all three California OCS planning areas. Specifically, the DPP proposes two lease sales in the Southern California planning area in 2020 and 2022, two sales in the Northern California planning area in 2021 and 2023, and two sales in the Central California planning area in 2021 and 2023. Pursuant to the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, every 5 years, BOEM undertakes a multi-step process to prepare a new 5-year oil and gas leasing program for all submerged lands on the OCS. The drafting of DPP is one of the first steps in this process. Subsequent steps include a proposed program and a programmatic environmental impact statement, and culminates with a five-year program approved by the Secretary of the Department of Interior. In summary, a five-year program proposes a five-year schedule for OCS oil and gas lease sales and identifies the expected intensity and location of those sales. The Department of Interior and BOEM are holding a public meeting in Sacramento on February 8th, that was mentioned earlier, to receive input on the 2019-2024 DPP. The resolution you're considering today is consistent with Governor Brown's longstanding opposition to new offshore oil and gas leasing. It is also consistent with over 35 years of California state policy that has been embraced by governors of both parties and many members of the California congressional delegation. The resolution also reflects the position of the majority of Californians on offshore oil and gas development. In July of 2017, the Public Policy Institute of California released a report indicating that public support for oil and gas drilling off the California coast was at an all-time low. According to the report, just 25% of Californians were in favor, while 69% were opposed. In conclusion, staff recommend that the Council adopt the draft resolution in support of the Chair of the OPC sending a letter to the Secretary of the Interior expressing the Council's opposition to renewed oil and gas exploration and leasing in the Pacific region and requesting that California be removed from further consideration by BOEM for renewed leasing in the 2019-2024 five-year plan. Comments must be submitted to the Secretary of the Department of Interior by March 9th.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And I would just note that last comment, anybody can submit comments. And so if you are moved, you can be moved. So by that day. We have three people that would like to speak. The first one is Anna Zivian from the Ocean Conservancy. And on deck is Leah Campbell from the California Coastkeeper Alliance.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Secretary Laird, council members, and staff. I really appreciate the historical account and stories you gave of opposition to drilling in California, and wanted to note that Ocean Conservancy is strongly supportive of this resolution. As the resolution notes, an oil spill on the California coast would be devastating for the coast, marine environment, our important network of marine protected areas, and our ocean economy, and would also put in jeopardy our ability to mitigate future climate change. California is a leader on both climate change and forward-looking ocean policy. Passing this resolution will further bolster that leadership and will support our state's efforts to prevent harm from offshore oil and gas exploration and drilling. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So Leah Campbell and then Sarah Sikich from Heal the Bay is on deck.
Good afternoon, council members. My name is Leah Campbell. I'm a senior policy analyst for California Coastkeeper Alliance. CCA has joined many of our environmental partners in submitting written comments prior to this meeting, which I believe Sarah Sikich following me will explain in more detail. We just want to thank OPC and the staff for their efforts to pursue a healthy marine environment in California and for taking a stand to defend California communities, ecosystems, and businesses from the unnecessary and unacceptable risk posed by new and expanded offshore drilling. As was sort of discussed at the beginning, over 25 California jurisdictions, as well as multiple state agencies, including the Fish and Game Commission, State Lands Commission, and Coastal Commission, have already passed similar resolutions opposing opening California's outer continental shelf to new fossil fuel development. Given OPC's longstanding mission to protect our ocean ecosystem, as well as the communities and businesses that depend on it, we're glad to see the council is joining this growing voice of opposition. California waterkeepers are acutely aware of the negative impacts of new and expanded oil and gas operations on our shoreline communities. For example, the obvious example is the 2015 Santa Barbara oil spill. Not only caused severe harm to fish, birds, and marine mammals, it also had devastating impacts on commercial fisheries, recreation and tourism, and coastal property values. Offshore drilling, sort of in conclusion, is fundamentally at odds with our coastal economy and our desired way of life. California has taken a position to intentionally forgo any revenue from new offshore oil and gas development in state waters for over 50 years, and instead focusing on developing clean, renewable energy. Even the federal government, as Secretary Laird mentioned, has recognized economic and environmental value of the California coast and has disallowed new oil and gas leases in federal offshore waters for over 30 years. You know, reversing these longstanding and deliberate decisions puts our coast at greater risk from oil spills and runs counter to California's ongoing efforts to transition our economy to one based around clean energy and to increase our resilience more generally to climate change. The Council's adoption of this proposed resolution affirms that California stands united in our opposition to new offshore oil and gas development and protected to committing our coastal communities and economy. So we thank you for your leadership to this issue and recommend that you approve this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then Sarah.
Good afternoon, council members. My name is Sarah Sikich. I'm vice president for Heal the Bay, and I'm here to speak on behalf of Heal the Bay in support of you taking action on this resolution and adopting it today. I've got a few slides to show you. Two weeks ago, Heal the Bay, California Coastkeeper Alliance, and Surfrider Foundation launched a change.org petition urging the public to take a stand and make their voice heard against the DPP proposal. And since its launch, this number is actually outdated, we've garnered over 100,000 signatures from people all over the world expressing their opposition to the BOEM draft proposal. These graphics illustrate a few different things. So this is the national support, and you see over 75,000 people who've stand out against this proposal from every state in the nation, ranging from California, who weighs in the largest. It's a heat map. The dark blue is the most support with over 16,000 signatures, to the less populous landlocked states where even folks in North Dakota, 65 of them, have signed the petition. The next slide shows that 21% of our signatures came from California, representing 57 of the 58 counties here in California. So very resounding opposition to the proposal. And then the next slide captures many of the comments that have been shared. We've received thousands of comments on the petition from people wanting to express why they're signing our petition. And so these are just a subset of them from all over the nation. The one that really resonates with me is from Amelia Copeland there in San Francisco, who's speaking as a nurse and a surfer, as a surfer and a mother of a child who has some immunocompromisation issues. This is really a bad proposal for public health and for the health of our oceans. So we'll be submitting all of this to BOEM. It will continue to update, and as soon as we have signatures the day before the deadlines are due, we'll submit them all through that portal. But it's just really an impressive way to see what the nation is saying here, California, and beyond. We did submit a letter of support for this resolution. There are a few whereas clauses that we recommended, including that go above and beyond what you have, to really articulate the importance of the California Current, its biodiversity, and the threats that this proposal would have to that biodiversity, as well as not just the impacts that a spill may have, but all of the exploration activities that lead up into development. So for your consideration, we'd love to see it strengthened, but if that's not possible today, your firm and strong action is greatly appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And it's before for questions and answers. And let me just make a comment on the last thing, which is that I would prefer sticking with the existing resolution because of its vetting thus far. But I want to note those points. And it is quite likely, since some of them were even in my opening comments, that they might be added to the comments that are made when the resolution is presented. So now is the chance for questions or comments or action. Michael, and then Mark.
A comment. I'm really glad to hear the support for this resolution. I want to add that it's actually, I think, more significant than than just opening up the leases, due to the current administration's actions and intent to further reduce the amount of regulations, particularly around the fossil fuel industry. So whatever risks we might imagine of development of petroleum resources off our shores and elsewhere on the OCS, I think given the administration's deregulation activities, we actually can't even imagine the scale of the risks that are potentially out there. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Mark.
Well, as a former coastal commissioner who was fortunate enough to have been welcomed into the commission by Peter Douglas, I'm reminded of his statement that the coast is never saved, always being saved. And there are times when we become complacent because we think we win battles, and this is a reminder that none of the battles we won or have won will really ever be permanent when it comes to protecting and our environment and the way that we have built California over time. And even with the awareness that was generated decades ago and the local ordinances, even with the fact that this seems more like a political stunt than reality in a practical sense, hence how lightly they took the issue when they took Florida off the list, which was just for political considerations, nothing practical, it's hard to truly understand where they're going or what's going to happen with this administration and what they're going to do. And we're left with doing whatever we can to hold on until that administration changes. The sooner that happens, the better. And we can remove some of these threats, really, to what California has built up over the years. And so we do have some protections with state lands, with the Coastal Commission, with local jurisdictions unwilling to expand onshore facilities. But yet there are still in California a number of onshore facilities that could be used should this move forward. And that exponentially exacerbates the threat to an area that has seen more than its fair share of oil spills and environmental decimation because of offshore drilling and the problems that accompany it. So I think this is a very appropriate action for the council to be taking. I would hope that this council would pass in the strongest terms possible a resolution opposing any expansion of offshore drilling, and that this remain a solid policy for the state of California, that we will not see expanded offshore drilling in either state or federal waters. And I appreciate the opportunity to weigh in.
Thank you for your comments. Jennifer.
Thank you, Secretary. I also want to express the State Lands Commission's support for this resolution. As was mentioned by one of the commenters earlier, the State Lands Commission did take a number of actions last year in preparation for this plan or in anticipation of this plan coming out. So we fully support a strong, robust statewide presence in opposing this effort. I do want to just touch on one small example of how the state being on this trajectory away from offshore oil and gas development. There's a number of examples mentioned in this resolution and other resolutions, but specifically, just last year, the commission leveraged the quit claim or the conveyance of six offshore oil and gas leases back to the state, which is now going to be resulting in the decommissioning of the last state offshore oil platform in Santa Barbara Channel, the decommissioning of an offshore oil island offshore Ventura County, two oil piers, and resulting in thousands of acres of offshore lands coming back into the coastal sanctuary and under those protections. And so that's just one small example of the trajectory that the state is on. And so, again, I just want to express the State Lands Commission's full support of this and our appreciation for OPC and the governor's office to also help coordinate our coastal agencies to ensure we represent the strongest opposition possible. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Bill.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. I don't have nearly the history that Secretary Laird has on this, but nobody does. But I just want to say...
I'm going to be hearing from Richard Charter any minute.
Okay. I just want to say that we are all unanimously in support of this resolution for all the right reasons. And if we're piling on, it's because that's where the people of California are. I think my suggestions are more in line with comments that might be in the cover letter to accompany this resolution, which would include the following points. One, We are approaching the 25th anniversary of the California Coastal Sanctuary Act, which prohibits new offshore oil development in state waters, period. 25 years. And I think that's a remarkable state of affairs. And I think it's also important to point out that the resolution talks about the economic impacts, but the coastal economic impacts alone are estimated at $44.5 billion a year. The PPIC survey is mentioned, and while that's important, an interesting part of the PPIC report is that coastal Republicans oppose new offshore oil development in California. And last but not least, I think it's also important to point out that the legislative role in this ongoing fight has been front and center in getting California to where it is now. And last year, there was a resolution that was opposing offshore oil that was passed with bipartisan support in the Senate. And so I think it's really important that the public understands that the opposition is not partisan in any sense. It's not geographic in any sense. This is a deeply ingrained opposition across the entire state. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Matt?
Yeah, I can be brief, Secretary Laird. Thank you. I also thought of Peter Douglas and the coast is never saved, but it's being saved. It's not unanticipated that from time to time we get tested on our resolve on these issues. I think by those who really don't see California or don't understand California. But I take great comfort out of the fact that this proposal has been made, and I don't think anybody questions how California as a state is going to respond to this proposal. It's a preposterous idea. We're not having anybody coming into meetings arguing in favor of this. We can't be complacent. I think, as the other speakers have noted, we need to take this seriously and we need to respond. But I don't think there's any question about where the state as a whole stands on this particular issue. And so we just need to make that absolutely clear to the federal government. Frankly, I think this is a hollow gesture. There's no thought really behind it.
The federal government's action is the hollow gesture.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Clarify that.
No, absolutely. This is a hollow gesture by the federal government. There's no thought behind it. There's no science behind it. We could certainly put an awful lot more in the resolution in terms of all the problems that we see presented by this. I'm sure they have been identified by the State Lands Commission and the Coastal Commission, talking about the lack of onshore infrastructure, talking about the risk, talking about the science, talking about the history. I mean, there's a reason why we haven't had offshore oil development in California. It's not just the opposition. It's just it hasn't been successful historically. There were previous leases that we litigated in the early 2000s that were not taken advantage of because of the opposition of the state, because it didn't make economic sense, because the risks were too great. So this is a very foolish gesture by the federal government. I am just going to assume that The secretary will work with the State Lands Commission, Coastal Commission, to coordinate with them and make sure that we say in our letter in the strongest possible way that this is a proposal that we object to and cannot go ahead. And I'm fine with the resolution the way it is because, as I said, we could spend hours loading it up with all the reasons why this is a foolish idea on the part of the federal government. I'll keep adding that in to make it clear. So,
that's good.
Thank you. And
your comments and Mr. Craven's comments are really noted about the additions, and those are things we'll think about. Mm-hmm. So is there a motion? Resolution. Motion by Mr. Brown.
Second.
Second by Mr. Rodriguez. Further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries unanimously. Thanks to everybody who worked on that. We will move to item number 5, an informational item, an update on Assembly Bill 2139 implementation, and Jen Phillips and Sarah Briley, I think, are going to present.
Thank you, and good afternoon, council members. So we're going to give a quick update on a snapshot of our work happening across the ocean acidification program. And I'll be co-presenting with our Climate Sea Grant fellow, Sarah Briley, who's been critical to many of our successes this past year. So while timely to share our progress, we are actually charged to do this per Assembly Bill 2139. Assembly Bill 2139 was signed by Governor Brown in September of 2016, a few months after the release of the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Science Panel. That bill directs OPC to establish an Ocean Acidification Science Task Force, coordinate agency action across the full suite of the panel's recommendations, and adopt recommendations for further action at the first meeting of the year, starting in 2018. So as mentioned by Karina just before, OPC has asked Ocean Science Trust to convene and coordinate an Ocean Acidification Science Task Force as called for in AB 2139 and the final recommendation of the West Coast panel. The task force purpose is to review efforts that are underway, bring the science community together to build off each other's work, and be an advisory body for policymakers and decision makers to ensure we are equipped with the most up-to-date science and information. Established earlier this month, I'd like to now introduce the members of the task force. Led by co-chairs Steve Weisberg of the Southern California Coastal Water Research Project, who I think is in the auditorium, and Francis Chan of Oregon State University, they will be joined by Sarah Cooley of Ocean Conservancy, Jim Berry of Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institution, Lisa Levin of Scripps Institution of Oceanography, Richard Feely of NOAA, Shallon Bush of NOAA, and Ali Baim of Stanford University. So further, AB 2139 directs OPC to take actions against ocean acidification with a few targeted recommendations from the West Coast panel. OPC is making progress across all of these actions as called out in the legislation and detailed further in the staff memo. For today, we're just going to focus on recommendations 4 and 5, and those are to facilitate agreements across entities to advance priorities on ocean acidification and to identify gaps between the monitoring of ocean acidification and the actions necessary to fill those gaps.
All right. So starting with the recommendation related to monitoring, OPC has been working with the Pacific Coast Collaborative and the Federal Interagency Working Group on Ocean Acidification on a West Coast Monitoring Task Force. Specifically, the task force aims to improve ocean acidification and hypoxia monitoring capacity along the West Coast through jointly building an integrated monitoring network that is responsive to management needs. The task force, made up of members from British Columbia, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California, inventoried monitoring projects within their respective monitoring communities. We collected information about physical, biogeochemical, and biological monitoring projects with a nexus to OA, as well as project details such as financial and operational security. This information is being made available in digital tools and maps for natural resource managers and researchers to assess gaps in the current monitoring network and expand monitoring where necessary through smart funding. So today I wanted to show you a sneak preview of some of the maps coming out of this monitoring inventory. I want to add here that California and Oregon are really leading these efforts, and so inventories in these states are nearly complete, but we're still adding many more projects in Washington, Alaska, and BC. This map shows different types of monitoring assets currently collecting OA and hypoxia-related observations along the West Coast, and by assets I mean a sensor or a site where data are collected. And these can include stations on a research cruise, sensors on a mooring, a sample collection site, or other types of monitoring, which are shown here. As we zoom in, we can explore different regions of our coast in more detail, such as the many monitoring assets in Monterey Bay. You can see several research cruise stations run through the bay, as well as moorings, sample sites, and other sensors. Each point contains all the detailed information of each project about how that data is collected and by whom. And there are many other ways that we can filter the information in the inventory depending on the questions we're interested in asking. I'm just going to show one additional map today. So, for example, we might want to see which monitoring assets are carbonate complete, meaning they're monitoring at least two parameters of carbonate chemistry. And these parameters allow us to better characterize the acidity of our oceans. And by applying these filters, we can quickly get a better sense of where gaps are when we look deeper into not just where we are monitoring, but also how we are monitoring. As for next steps, the task force is currently working to integrate more monitoring information from BC, Alaska, and Washington. At the same time, we're working with partners to host this information online through existing data portals, so that the inventory can be easily accessed and downloaded. And later this year, the task force will bring together state and federal policymakers and scientists to evaluate the inventory to identify and fill critical gaps along the West Coast. In the long term, outcomes from this inventory will help OPC prioritize monitoring gaps and funding decisions. All right. So similarly, OPC has already made progress in expanding monitoring along the West Coast, such as an OPC-funded project led by Dr. Christy Croker at UC Santa Cruz and Dr. Jan Freewald at California Reef Check, who are studying marine protected area effectiveness in the face of changing ocean conditions. This project aims to fill in some of the gaps in OA and hypoxia monitoring coverage by installing additional sensors in places where data is limited. The inventory I just showed you played a large role in identifying these sites. So the team has been busy deploying sensors this summer and fall, and so we wanted to take the time now to show you how these sensors are deployed. So I'm not
sure. Can I take over?
Yes, please.
The video?
Yeah. Oh.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. So the last piece that we would like to talk about related to AB 2139 is related to facilitating agreements across entities. And as you've heard about before, California, with Ocean Protection Council as its representative, is a founding member of the International Alliance to Combat Ocean Acidification. The OA Alliance is comprised of 58 government and affiliate members, including nations, subnational entities, tribes, and non-governmental organizations. As of COP23, we have welcomed new members, including the Seychelles, Fiji, Sweden, Iceland, and the City of Portland. And at COP23, we hosted events underscoring the need to develop regional strategies that help countries adapt and build resiliency along their coastlines to ocean acidification. So the last piece of this is charging OPC to consider recommendations on next steps on ocean acidification. So most immediately, we are asking for consideration of funding for California's Ocean Acidification Action Plan, which I will discuss in the next item of the meeting. We'll also come back to you throughout the year on updates on our monitoring, current grants, and future funding. Thank you very much for your consideration of this item.
And before I ask if there's questions or comments from the council, I have one request to speak on this, and it's Anna Zivian of the Ocean Conservancy.
Hi, Anna Zivian, Ocean Conservancy, Senior Research Fellow. Just wanted to say that we really appreciate all the work OPC staff is doing to further the implementation of AB 2139. A bill we supported for its recognition that the findings of the West Coast Ocean Acidification and Hypoxia Task Force need to be translated into policy. We commend the progress to date and appreciate the convening of a science task force to continue to provide science, provide and assess science and information to inform future action. We're also very pleased and grateful that Ocean Conservancy's Ocean Acidification Director, Sarah Cooley, will be a task force member and look forward to working on the priorities outlined by OPC staff. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions or comments of council members? Then I'm just going to have one. And the thing about it is that it's tough to know where to divide it between this and the next item. So I thought I'd just go for it right now, because okay. It seems like we have two items on the same thing in one way. When we had a report last year from Rafe Zadella, or maybe the year before, he was noting, because I had always said in terms of ocean acidification, barring all the extra science we're constantly getting, that it is really the carbon absorbed from the atmosphere and near shore impacts from agriculture. And he sort of corrected me and said, well, now, due to additional work, it's clear that there are nearshore impacts due to sewer outfalls and the nutrients that are contained in them in a significant amount. And there was a question about the Water Board because of their just the criteria that they do in their standards. And I understand from this that they're waiting for more information about nutrient loading to decide whether they think they need to revise these or how to revise them to accept the fact that that is a difference that we're recognizing now in sort of nearshore factors for ocean acidification. Mm-hmm. Having said that long-winded setup, what's it going to take to sort of move to get them the information they think they need to do that? You know, it's one thing to wait until things are being studied. At what point do we reach critical mass to where we have information that they find useful so they can begin to address it through their criteria?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think, first of all, we're already investing in the science that the Water Board needs to make any changes to revising their water quality criteria or changes in their nutrient assessments. So that's our West Coast-wide model that's funded to UCLA. And that model is in its validation phase, so we expect to have some results soon. But I think because we're talking about issues of revising water quality criteria for ocean acidification, something that hasn't been done before, or changing our nutrient assessments or revising those based on what we see, we need to have really strong and consensus-driven science. So they will wrap up that model, but then also we'll need to have it peer-reviewed and published so that the Water Board can point to that and can point to widely accepted science when they attempt to revise criteria or adjust their nutrient assessments. So I would say the criteria piece is the lofty long-term goal, and then the nutrient assessments, kind of changing how much nutrient loading, as you were talking about with Rafe, is something that could happen in a few years, but we're pushing it as fast as we can with the science and communicating with the Water Board on this. And Steve Weisberg is here if we want to bring him up and have him add any caveats to what I just said.
Actually, I want no caveats.
Okay.
I think I just want to be heard, because the real issue is, and you know it's my pet peeve, because when we were had the first proposal to do the sea level rise science, it was like, oh, we need to do it full-blown the way we did last time and peer-reviewed. And it was the earliest date it was going to be delivered was the fourth from the last date of the administration.
Right.
And we figured out a way to synthesize existing to be able to move, to be able to do the guidance in a timely fashion. And I totally appreciate the need for consensus-based peer-reviewed science. But I also appreciate the fact that I'd like to see this done in my natural life. That sometime I would like
reasonable.
To see this happen. You know, and so I think I flag it just for the sense of urgency that we can just not lose sight of it. And if it means that Water Board members need to not sit back and have it delivered to them and maybe participate in some of this as it goes along so they can understand it and get it and then be even more ready to move, then maybe that's a way to deal with it. But
so
I just want action.
Just one last point on Water Board participating. They already are. So there's a kind of advisory committee for this model that OPC's funded. They're part of that. They're tracking this model progress just as I am. So, you know, I don't think they're just sitting back and waiting. They're engaged in the conversation, and we're going to continue to engage them.
Well, thank you for correcting that so they didn't think that I even slighted them.
So, you're welcome.
You know, I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments? Then thank you. And we'll move to item 6, which is the authorization to disperse of Prop 84 funds. And my note says Jen will already be at the podium.
I'm here. So we are bringing a few projects across our fisheries and climate change programs to the council to consider funding pursuant to Proposition 84. We're excited about these opportunities and continuing our leadership, especially in the face of a changing climate, which we've been talking about so much today. And building on what I just talked about in item 5, I'll kick off with consideration of funding to the Ocean Science Trust to assist OPC in developing and releasing California's Ocean Acidification Action Plan as part of our commitment to the International Ocean Acidification Alliance. This project cost will be up to $250,000, and Ocean Science Trust will provide content support, facilitate scientific review, and develop outreach and communication materials. The outcomes will be several, including an action plan for California that is comprehensive, statewide, and bold, an action plan that is forward-looking and outlines our vision over the next several years, and an action plan that can be a model to other regions, states, and countries of the Alliance as they outline different avenues and mechanisms of action. Overall, we're initiating this process today to be one of the first action plans of the coalition. And as a quick reminder, members of the Alliance commit to developing these action plans to advance the 5 goals of the Alliance, which span from research and monitoring to adaptation and mitigation to outreach and education. Going back a little bit, though, to provide assistance to members in building action plans, the West Coast states built an action plan toolkit to exchange the latest science, share examples of existing action plans, and detail actions from regulatory to non-regulatory and modest to bold that governments can take to mitigate, adapt, and respond to ocean acidification. The content in that toolkit has been collected and adapted from several sources, and it will be continuously updated as we learn new information about this field. The toolkit will be a resource for Ocean Protection Council and the Ocean Science Trust to draw from as we build the California Action Plan. So, as far as why now, it's timely for California to develop our action plan because there's great momentum from COP23, where the OA Alliance had a prominent role, and the current COP president, Fiji, launched the Ocean Pathway Partnership to ensure that the ocean is an integral part in global climate agreements and agendas. Additionally, the OA Alliance registered a voluntary commitment, committing to 60 members by June 2018 and 15 action plans by June 2019 at the UN conference in New York this past summer. And finally, the upcoming Global Climate Action Summit in September in San Francisco could be a great venue and deadline for releasing California's action plan. So on this slide is a brief overview of the steps members might take to build an action plan, and it will be a framework for California to follow. As an exhibit to your materials is a letter of commitment that was signed by Governor Brown, committing to the goals and the call to action of the Alliance. Building on that, ongoing work that California has funded and is leading will be reflected in our action plan, as well as longer-term goals and activities. Finally, we will also have a robust public process, and we are working now to figure out how to release and scope that action plan so it's received and held up as a model for other global governments. As far as timing for this effort, we aim to have it ready to release by September 2018. We will be scoping the action plan and drafting in early 2018. This will be followed by extensive public outreach and feedback, and we will engage the recently established Ocean Acidification Science Task Force for scientific merit and feasibility of the action plan. In the late summer to early fall, we will come back to the OPC for consideration and potential adoption of the action plan. And following that, we will widely release and roll out the action plan at a relevant international venue. Early in 2019 and on, we will implement California's action plan and continue the great work we've been doing over the past few years. So thank you for your consideration of this funding, and I'll turn it over to Chris Potter.
Thank you, Jen. The project that I'll be presenting this afternoon addresses OPC's strategic plan objectives that aim to, one, improve policies and regulatory practices in ways that restore natural sediment processes while increasing opportunities for sediment reuse, and two, increases the availability of data and tools that can influence sediment-related planning decisions. The project proponent, the Greater Farallones Association, will complete a sediment management action plan for the Greater Farallones National Marine Sanctuary and the Northern Management Area of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. This will be achieved by examining data gaps and identifying solutions to obstacles for protecting habitats, ensuring public access, preparing for sea level rise, and maintaining critical infrastructure. Existing and emerging efforts for planning would be combined into the action plan to create a holistic regional approach to have cumulative benefits. It's important to note that the action plan will build upon the soon-to-be-completed coastal regional sediment management plans for the Sonoma Marin Coast, the San Francisco Open Coast, and the already completed Santa Cruz Regional Sediment Management Plan. By focusing on actions that can be implemented within the two sanctuaries, in addition, this project will enable the two sanctuaries to take a holistic view of the sediment management within their management areas. So in California, coastal sediment management is coordinated in large part by the Coastal Sediment Management Workgroup, CSMW, which is co-chaired by the OPC and the Army Corps of Engineers. In a nutshell, the CSMW is a collaborative of state and federal agencies and NGOs committed to addressing California's coastal sediment management imbalances through a restoration of natural processes and beneficial reuse of sediment on a regional system-wide basis. This proposal was fostered by the CSMW in collaboration with the Greater Fair Lawns and the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuaries. Last, this project is strongly supported by the two sanctuaries, which will be providing a substantial in-kind match to an OPC grant of $85,000. Next, Paige Barabee will present a project focusing on fisheries management. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm excited to present two projects that advance OPC's fisheries program through supporting innovative science-based approaches and strategic partnerships to inform efficient and adaptive fisheries management. The first project would provide up to $190,000 to Fathom Consulting to collect and synthesize information on 30 state-managed marine species. The California Ocean Protection Act, or COPA, states that a goal of all state actions shall be to improve data gathering and advance scientific understanding to continually improve efforts to protect and manage coastal ecosystems. These 30 synthesis reports could inform California Department of Fish and Wildlife, or CDFW's, development of enhanced status reports, augmenting 6 enhanced status reports that will be developed by CDFW and increasing the amount of publicly available fisheries data. This project will be advanced in close collaboration with OPC and CDFW staff. The reports will include species-specific information on the fishery, including landings and value over time, past and current management measures, monitoring and essential fishery information, and future management needs. Once complete, the synthesis reports will be posted on OPC's website and remain accessible to stakeholders, decision makers, and the public. The second project would provide just under $31,000 to Strategic Earth Consulting to convene a series of multi-interest roundtable discussions to design and develop an online California fisheries portal. COPA directs OPC to support state agencies' use and sharing of scientific and geospatial information for ocean-relevant decision-making, and to ensure this information is publicly accessible and tools are available for visualizing and analyzing these data. Once an initial set of enhanced status reports is completed by CDFW, these reports may form the core content of an online California fisheries portal, which will serve as a web-based central repository and public interface for marine fisheries information in the state. To ensure the portal is effective and useful for all users, communication and engagement with stakeholders from the beginning is essential. Developing a California fisheries portal will promote transparency in fisheries management, increase access to state marine resources information, help foster public engagement, and focus academic research on areas of management relevance. These two projects also have the potential to advance the implementation phase of the MLMA Master Plan Amendment. This slide shows the 6 species for which CDFW plans to develop enhanced status reports in blue, and the 30 state-managed marine species pertaining to the synthesis project as species number 7 through 36. These 36 species were identified in the current master plan process based on their value to the state, as they represent the majority of commercial landings value, as well as commercial and recreational participation. In February 2017, the department held a public webinar in which positive feedback was received from stakeholders regarding the implementation of a scaled management approach, as well as the general approach to the fisheries portal. Scaled management can range from an enhanced status report to a standard fishery management plan, depending on complexity of each fishery, degree of anticipated management change, and available resources. This slide shows some conceptual drafts of the fisheries portal, including a landing page where users select a specific fishery and learn essential fishery information. In addition to providing easy access and navigation to enhanced status reports, the fisheries portal may also provide the ability to query and graph data, as well as map effort landings and other fisheries information, providing a helpful visualization and analysis tool. And the focus groups will build off of this initial public webinar discussion. The grantees were selected based on demonstrated effectiveness in collaborating with OPC and CDFW to advance fisheries management objectives, in-depth knowledge of MLMA Master Plan Amendment process, trusting relationships with fishing constituent groups, and capacity for timely completion of the projects. OPC's support of these projects would build on $390,000 of previous OPC investment that supported four projects informing the information gathering phase of the master plan amendment process. These two projects will improve the management of California's fisheries by providing up-to-date species-specific information on state fisheries and through soliciting feedback from stakeholders on the development of a publicly accessible, useful fisheries portal to inform the sustainable use and conservation of state marine resources. Thank you.
Does that complete your presentation?
Yes.
Okay. Then there are three pieces of this, and we can, when it comes back to us, have questions or comments and take action on it as a whole package or different pieces if there are issues. But I have five people that have requested to speak on this, so we're going to take them now. The first one is Anna Zivian from the Ocean Conservancy, and on deck is Debbie Asseltine Nielsen from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Thank you. With a last name that starts with a Z, I'm not used to being first in the list all the time, so I appreciate that. Ocean Conservancy would like to comment on a couple of their recommendations for disbursement of Proposition 84 funds. First, we support funds to be used on the development of California's Ocean Acidification Action Plan and appreciate California's leadership in the International Alliance to Combat Ocean Acidification. We further encourage OPC to focus on concrete, tangible activities to address ocean acidification and hypoxia effects, including actions that have co-benefits for the overall health of our coasts and ocean, like restoration and other no-regrets policy measures to reduce pollution. In addition, we encourage California, as a leader of the alliance, to address not only ocean acidification and hypoxia, but broader changing ocean conditions, including the effects of multiple interacting stressors that can exacerbate the impacts of ocean acidification and hypoxia. California's Ocean Acidification Action Plan will be a model for other jurisdictions, subnational, national, and regional, and OPC, with OST's support, can ensure that our forward-looking effective policy can improve ocean and coastal health, both in California and globally. We also support the disbursement of Proposition 84 funds to develop enhanced status reports and support stakeholder discussions to inform the development of the online fisheries data portal. These activities will benefit sustainable management of California's fisheries, and I'm sure the project that Chris introduced is also terrific, but it's not something that we work on specifically. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next is Debbie, and on deck is Leah Campbell from the California Coastkeeper Alliance.
Hi, I'm Debbie Asseltine Nielsen, Senior Environmental Scientist with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I just want to say glad to be here to Secretary Laird and council members. And I am here to speak in support of funding the two proposed projects included under sustainable fisheries. For the past 2 years, the Department of Fish and Wildlife and its partners, with support from OPC and others, have been working to update the Marine Life Management Act master plan. The draft master plan will be submitted to the Fish and Game Commission at its meeting next week, and the Fish and Game Commission is expected to adopt the amended master plan in June. The amended, within the master plan, we have the amended framework for the Marine Life Management Act based management. That's a lot big term there, so I'm just going to start saying MLMA. And it's a key component of the MLMA master plan, and you received within your materials a figure that shows that framework. That framework was developed to standardize our approach to state-managed fisheries, and it incorporates a wide group of factors, including climate change and ecosystems. The department has prioritized the completion of status reports and development of an online fisheries portal as projects that can be undertaken prior to adoption of the master plan. And the enhanced status reports are a key or important component of that framework that we show there for fisheries management, and will help the department to focus its research and management efforts. OPC financial support will advance the collection and synthesis of information on 30 state-managed marine species, and this information may help to inform the development of those enhanced status reports. The finalized synthesis reports, as Paige said, will be posted on OPC web's page. So very important part. These monies will be used to move this particular component of what we're looking at forward for our MLMA management. The development of the online fisheries portal will enhance the department's ability to effectively share fisheries information. As was noted, soliciting feedback from stakeholders is an important step in the development of this portal, and OPC funding will support the convening of stakeholder discussions, which will provide this important feedback. As I mentioned, these projects both will support the department's implementation of MLMA. We greatly appreciate the continued support of the council and the strong working relationship we have with the council staff. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So Leah Campbell's up, and on deck is Richard Sadowski.
Good afternoon again. My name is still Leah Campbell, and I'm still a senior policy analyst for California Coastkeeper Alliance. CCKA submitted written comments prior to this meeting supporting the disbursement of Prop 84 funds for the development of California's Ocean Acidification Action Plan in partnership with various groups, including NRDC, Ocean Conservancy, PCFFA, Azul, Audubon California, Wild Coast, Heal the Bay, Surfrider Foundation, California Coastal Protection Network, and the Center for Biological Diversity. I want to reiterate our support and thank OPC and OST staff for their work on this issue. CCKA is an affiliate member of the International Alliance to Combat Ocean Acidification, and we're proud of California's leadership in that alliance. As my colleague from Ocean Conservancy briefly discussed, we have two overarching points to raise regarding the action plan. To ensure that it's effective, and as Jen Phillips said in her presentation, comprehensive, bold, and forward-looking. Firstly, we urge OPC and OST in the development of the action plan to prioritize practicable and tangible solutions to mitigate and adapt to ocean acidification impacts. Organizations have been longtime supporters of the strategic use of OPC resources to support critical research projects to understand the causes and long-term impacts of acidification. This research should continue, but parallel to that effort, we can and must pursue precautionary, no-regrets policy and restoration measures to increase the overall resilience of our oceans to acidification and climate change. The West Coast OAH panel report, for example, outlines specific policy solutions and concrete recommendations that should be incorporated into the action plan. Secondly, we request that the action plan not be limited purely to addressing ocean acidification hypoxia. In fact, the initial vision of the International OAH Alliance was one that would address the threats posed by changing ocean conditions more broadly. As such, California's action plan should address other changes in the marine environment that may result from or contribute to acidification or decrease our resilience more generally, including warming temperatures and harmful algal blooms. We don't seek to dilute the available funds, but we believe it is critical that the action plan yield multiple ocean health benefits and address climate-driven threats to our ocean more generally. As Jen said in her presentation, California is one of the first government members to initiate development of an action plan, and as such, we have a unique opportunity to set a strong precedent in the alliance that action plans advance specific tangible solutions and address both acidification and other threats to the health of our marine environment. In addition, with the forthcoming Governor's Climate Summit in September, California's action plan has the potential to shape oceans resilience work in states and nations around the world. We thank OPC and OST again for their commitment to and leadership on this issue, and our organizations look forward to working with staff in the coming months on the development of the plan. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Sadowski, and on deck is Sarah Sikich. You know, Mr. Sadowski, this is the eighth year I've presided over this where you have testified at least once every year, and it says Richard E.T. Sadowski, and you know, I've never asked you what the E.T. stands for.
I have
My birth name is Richard Edmund Tuhanovich Sadowski. My father was in charge of a Polish resistance in 1939 in Poland when Germans attacked and the Bolsheviks attacked from the east. And he had to have an alias to protect the family. So that's where the Tuhanovich Sadowski and Edmund was his name. So my name is...
That is a great story.
Yeah.
That is a great story. I'm glad I asked, and I'll try not to count it against your time.
Okay. I'm here. I'm also on the Morro Bay Planning Commission, and I'm here to because we have a problem. We have a political breakdown locally in our city of Morro Bay. Within recently, the regional board had requested that the Morro Bay City Council take a look at a sewer plant that we're going to be moving at a managed retreat to have it west of the highway, west of Highway 1, which runs right along Morro Bay, through Morro Bay. And the response by the city council was to cancel all the meetings, direct staff, cancel all the citizen advisory meetings, which I sit on as well, and to direct staff not to discuss land use in that area. And one of the council people actually went to the local paper and local news agency and said that we'd never even consider it. This project is under the pretense of sea level rise and climate change is going to be a gentrification of our community just from the cost. And I would like to, from a lack of, I'm kind of exasperated trying to deal with staff and the different agencies, and I'm asking you guys to consider something like this. We have a drinking water aquifer that's, you know, adjacent to the shoreline that is already been proven that is polluted by sewage from a remediation, a MTBE remediation action that occurred in Shell Oil back several years ago. The sucralose test proved that there's sewage there. What I would love to see is maybe with the help of the Ocean Protection Council and Ocean Science Trust to take a look and do a test, a pharmaceutical test in our Morro Basin aquifer, and then replace the sewer main that MTBE was found in that sewer main. That's how they found that the Shell oil tanks were leaking. Well, those sewer lines are also exfiltrating sewage, and the remediation action occurred right at the boundary layer of a drinking water aquifer. If we fix that line, if we come in and there's capacity issues, fix that line and then do a post test for nitrates and pharmaceuticals in the drinking water aquifer, it will help just from the whole state. We're only a city of 10,000 people, but it'll be a great pilot project. And I think that and this is all related to ocean acidification. Even the, you know, we're dealing with ocean on the surface, but we also got these drinking water aquifers and dealing with saltwater intrusion and stuff. So I would appreciate a consideration in that.
Okay, thank you very much. You know, I thought about it for a second, and I don't think I've heard the word Bolshevik used in public testimony since I was on the Santa Cruz City Council. But thank you. We appreciate your testimony. And last is Sarah Sikich.
Good afternoon, Council Members. Sarah Sikich, Vice President of Heal the Bay. I'm here to support the Prop 84 disbursement of funds for these projects and wanted to speak specifically to the fisheries-related projects. Heal the Bay has been tracking and participating in the MLMA master plan update process along with several fisheries stakeholders, and we view this updated plan and outline management actions, including scaled management tools and the online fisheries data portal, as key to sustainable and successful management of our state's fisheries. We believe the data portal will be an effective tool to ensuring transparency and public accessibility to California's fishery management processes, and including stakeholders in the development of this portal will ensure that the final product is user-friendly and informative as possible. Furthermore, The development of the ESRs for priority fisheries will help Department of Fish and Wildlife move forwards in a leveraged, informed, and efficient manner to see that the MLMA is implemented, which historically has been onerous and resource-intensive. And lastly, through the disbursement of funds, if they're approved, we recommend that the OPC encourage the Department of Fish and Wildlife to leverage fisheries partnerships to support the department in key management tasks. Such partnerships could facilitate coordination and sharing of available tools, knowledge, and resources, and we believe that they will help facilitate the MLMA implementation. We thank the Council for your commitment to advancing science-based management of California's ocean resources and your dedication to ensuring transparency and public accessibility in these decision-making processes. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Now the matter is back before the Council for questions, comments, and action. Any comments, questions? Yes, Michael.
Questions for both Jen and Chris. Jen, on the ocean acidification plan, am I correct that not only will it include a set of actions, but implementation strategies for those actions? And then my question is, will it include, and if it doesn't, would you consider including measures and metrics by which the council can assess whether the action plan is being effective in achieving its goals?
Yeah, that's a great suggestion. So, I mean, we're just at the beginning of kind of it's assessing the shape of the action plan, but I think those are two great comments you made about not only just saying what actions we're going to take, but how we're going to implement them, and then a way of tracking success over time. So those are all things we can definitely be thinking about. And I did want to echo...
Well, let me ask a quick follow-up to that. Without any other action but us approving what's in front of us, you're going to take that into account and try to take seriously what he said about measuring the effectiveness?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just checking.
there was a couple of public comments about being broader than ocean acidification. And since this is part of our international commitment or our commitment to the International Alliance, which does mention changing ocean conditions and thinking more holistically and about multi-stressors, we're definitely going to be thinking about that as well.
Did that complete your questions?
I have one for
Chris.
Okay.
For me, great. Yes.
Equal opportunity.
You don't have to go to the third.
I'm good on the third.
Good. Okay.
So the money's for sediment plans for two areas, and my question is, in developing these plans, are there aspects to the two areas such that the things you would do the things you're proposing to do in this plan, and I'll throw in, by the way, the implementation and everything else there, that apply elsewhere in the state and of particular concern that I have in the South Coast region of Southern California, which is Ventura up through Santa Barbara counties, armoring of the coast is, particularly in Ventura, there's like 20 miles of armor from one end to the other. And sediment transport is just a really big issue.
Right. So, as it turns out, the jurisdiction of the Greater Farallones and the northern management area of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary overlap nicely with four coastal sediment management plans that the OPC's work group have developed over the last 5 years.
So you know, it makes the scope of the project pretty easy to lay out. In Southern California, in Central California as well, the work group has developed a number of sediment management plans. They're older, and we're just beginning to strategize about updating them because there's lots of new information and management perspectives have changed as well. Does that get close to what you're looking for?
I think so.
Okay.
Okay. We'll wait and see.
Yeah. The other thing I would mention is that our work group has been trying to foster a relationship with the sanctuaries for a number of years now. And it's just been within the last 2 years that the sanctuaries have really kind of embraced these issues. So we're taking advantage of that opportunity.
Okay, Mark?
I just want to respond a little bit to that, because I would hope that the work that gets done along the with the two sanctuaries and along that stretch of coast would be informative. And one of the things that we are really struggling with in California is understanding many development impacts that have negatively affected sediment transport. Right. And a lot of decisions that get made, such as coastal armoring and other things. And as seas rise and as the systems that we're relying on are changing, with the having taken so much sediment out or the things we've done with sediment really impact wetlands' abilities to migrate, for example, or to grow, because we have, even if we're not armoring coasts per se, we have armored what's behind the coast and what's behind all the wetlands. And so understanding all those interactions and all the sediment that does or doesn't come out of San Francisco Bay out and around the Monterey Bay, and especially it's acute at the Salinas River where there's been a lot of sediment that's been held up the Salinas River, and because that canyon then traps anything from the north moving down, really understanding those dynamics is what I think that they're trying to do. And really,
yeah, that's certainly an aspect of it.
Yeah, and get a handle on it. And then even with the sand mining operation that was happening in Marina that had a direct impact on coastal erosion just down coast there, is a lot of this issue in a microcosm. So I'm happy to hear you bring up the issue about coastal armoring. I think that's very serious. And the worry is the response to rising seas and changing amounts of water, how that comes in, the timing, is going to want to do something quick and dirty like armoring the coast, which is probably extremely detrimental to what we need to accomplish here in California. So I would expect this information to be very useful. It's geographically specific, but concepts probably more useful across California.
It's a pretty big section of the coast.
It's a very big section of the coast and very dynamic.
Other questions or comments? Then I just have one of Paige before we move to potential action. And it's just, you explained the 30 species and all that stuff very clearly, but for my colloquial public policy mind, I thought I would just try to translate it to make sure I understood it. Because under the MLMA, we would do these individual species plans, and I've lost track. Since it had enacted, we'd only done 3 or 6, and they were costing $900,000 or $1 million because we did it just to the nth degree, which is great, but it just meant with all these species, we didn't have the resources to do them. And so we adopted some measures to streamline them, and that seems to be what's embodied here. And so if we're going to do it in a new streamlined version that doesn't cause as much, that gets us actually to the end of the studies, that's what I think the 30 species are. How does it fit in that continuum? So I just understand we no longer do the bells and whistles. We're trying to streamline it. We're turning to this process. What does that mean toward getting to the end and doing species plans of these 30? Like, how does that all fit?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I think I would clarify that point when I was talking about scaled management. So the continuum ranges from the enhanced status report, which is the most streamlined version of a management tool for state fisheries management, all the way up to a standard fishery management plan, which is what you're speaking to, I believe, where there's white sea bass and nearshore fin fish, spiny lobster, and market squid that are completed. And then red abalone and Pacific herring are in the process of being completed. So the enhanced status report wouldn't replace a standard FMP, but it's an additional management tool that there isn't up-to-date species-specific information on.
But
these.
If we were going to do a full report at some point, does this tool get us partway there and helps us launch us into that easier?
Yes, it definitely would compile and synthesize the latest information on that species that could inform.
Okay.
That. Yes.
Just trying to understand, because I know we're trying to get these done and in a way, and I knew this was part of it, but it wasn't as clear. So I appreciate
Thank
that.
You.
I think that clarifies it.
Great.
Any other questions? If somebody were so moved, the motion probably, unless you want to divide it up, is a motion to adopt the proposed findings for all projects as recommended by staff, approve the projects as described, and delegate to the executive director the authority to implement the council's approval.
That sounds like the motion I was about to make.
Then I heard a so move. Did I hear a second?
A second.
A second. Is there any further discussion?
I'll just say that one of the things that has made California a leader when we're looking at climate change is the actions that the state has taken. So we can demonstrate there have been results from the programs that we have adopted and implemented here in the state. And if we're going to be also a leader in this area in ocean acidification and cleaning our oceans, we really do need to follow through and show that we're taking concrete actions, talk about how we're implementing those actions, and be able to demonstrate results. So I think this is a very, very positive step in that direction. But I think it's also an absolutely necessary one if we want to continue to lead the rest of the world to look at the issues associated with ocean health and particularly ocean acidification. So I will be enthusiastic in voting in favor of the motion.
And since you did that, let me add to that and also to what Mike said, because I think when we were at the UN Oceans Conference in June, we were so hungry to get people to sign on, and we thought our big progress was constantly being able to say Emirates, Iceland, countries in the Pacific that I've never heard of, and, you know, to add to France and Chile to keep showing the forward movement. And now, as Matt said, there's been such a response that we have to stand back and make sure that people execute. Because this sort of moved as faster than we had really dreamed of. And so now it is making sure. And I think the thing that I learned, Matt is much more schooled at international diplomacy, given what he's had to do with Under 2 and the other things. But going to the UN and watching that it's not this massive mandate, it's a coalition of individual commitments that adds to the action, and then realizing that's what we were seeking and that's what we were getting. And it's why, just to make a gratuitous post-State of the Union comment, why it was so stupid we pulled out of Paris, because it was nothing but individual commitments. You don't like our commitment, scale it down or change it. There's no reason to pull out of everybody operating in that process. And so I keep seeing Jen nodding, so I know that she has heard us, and she's going to make sure that these are implemented with some accountability. Mm-hmm. Any further comments before a vote? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries unanimously. Thank you very much to the people that presented. We're going to move to item number 7. It's reauthorizing the OPC's investment in the California Fisheries Fund and transfer the administration to a new entity.
Thank you, Secretary Laird and council members. So OPC has reached a 10-year check-in point at which to consider reauthorizing its investment in fisheries lending. I'm excited to share the background and need that spurred the creation of the California Fisheries Fund, highlights from the fund's 10-year history of success, and details on the transfer recommendation. The California Fisheries Fund is a revolving loan fund that supports sustainable commercial fisheries. The fund's mission is to help borrowers succeed in fisheries that achieve environmental conservation, improved profitability for the industry, and stability for port communities. The California Ocean Protection Act states that OPC may support sustainable fisheries through the creation of revolving loan programs for the purpose of implementing sustainable fishery projects. In 2008, it was identified that fishing communities lacked the necessary funding to adapt to new environmentally friendly regulations. The California Fisheries Fund, or CFF, was established to provide a stable, accessible source of capital to support California's evolving harbor communities. Historically, banks and credit unions have been mostly unwilling to provide loans to commercial fishermen due to the potential for marginal profits and the general unpredictability of the fishing industry representing a higher risk. The CFF model is unique in that it allows fishermen to use fishing boats, permits, and Pacific groundfish quota as collateral. This allows for the use of a powerful new asset that can be securitized in order to access capital supporting both environmental and economic benefits. In 2008, OPC, then in coordination with State Coastal Conservancy, approved a $2 million grant from Proposition 84 to Environmental Defense Fund to develop and administer the fund. Private foundations also invested over $2.3 million to capitalize the CFF. The CFF has had a successful 9 years of operation, supporting 38 loans to 27 borrowers ranging from $10,000 to $300,000, totaling almost $4.8 million since the first loan closed in 2009. The total corpus is over $3.2 million, and the fund has revolved 1.4 times since its initiation. Some borrowers have applied for a second loan after paying back their first loan, demonstrating the trust that has been developed between the fishing community and the CFF. OPC's initial contribution was $1.4 million, not including administrative costs. $300,000 was allocated for administrative costs initially, and an additional $300,000 was allocated to cover needed ongoing operating expenses. There has been a partial loss from one borrower of about $43,800 to OPC's contribution, resulting in about $1.36 million of OPC's contribution remaining. CFF loans are term loans and lines of credit that range from 1 to 10 years with an interest rate between 4 and 8%, depending on market interest rates and specific borrower circumstances. Borrowers include fishermen, processors, distributors, ports, communities, and nonprofit organizations. To ensure alignment between a loan applicant and the fund, CFF analyzes 10 loan criteria, which are outlined in Exhibit B. For example, the first loan criteria is alignment with CFF's core goals to enable a healthy environment and healthy local economy. Loan purposes include vessel purchase, vessel or gear upgrades, purchase of fishing permits, working capital, non-vessel equipment, dockside infrastructure, and purchase or lease of Pacific groundfish quota. And many loans include more than one of these purposes. I'd now like to share a 3-minute video clip in which borrowers share their stories about how they've used their loans to improve the sustainability and profitability of their fishing businesses.
With the loan money, I bought the boat. It's a nice, proven, durable boat. We fish in a lot of hard weather. I'm Steve Fitz. The vessel's the Mr. Morgan, and we're here in Half Moon Bay. Upon arrival here, it was outfitted with this gear. It's called Scottish Seine gear. We're the only boat in the country that has this gear type on it. And actually, it's considered to be an environmentally friendly way to harvest groundfish. Commercial fishing is such a very risky business, and because of it, a lot of banks aren't willing to loan against that risk. And so CFF is, in a sense, they're taking that risk. You know, they've offered real competitive and fair rates. I would recommend it to any fisherman that's considering, you know, getting in or trying to do something different, buy a boat. But if they need some money to help them, I would recommend it.
Graduated from high school and went to Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo as a marine biology major. My name is Owen Hackelman. This is the fishing vessel Provision, and we're here in Morro Bay, California. Initially, I worked with my dad, and then what I heard about California Fisheries Fund, I realized that I could potentially have my own fishing business. I think programs like the CFF are important because otherwise local fishermen wouldn't be able to afford to buy boats and permits. One thing that tends to happen in fishing is it tends to become consolidated and the little guys don't have a chance to make it. I think that's pretty sad.
I have a good relationship with my banks. And when I told them what I wanted to do, I wanted to go commercial fishing, they're like, oh no, we're not gonna do that. We'll help you do any other kind of business that you like. If you wanna get a pleasure boat, no problem. If you need warehousing this or that, no problem. Commercial fishing, no, won't touch it. My name is Dan Durbin. The name of my vessel is Golden Girl. She is port of San Francisco. We got together with California Fisheries Fund. And what happened after that was really pretty nice. They weren't really interested in to hear any other type of fishing operations other than sustainably caught fishing. And that's something that's very important to me, being a fisherman who hopes to fish for a long time. And I hope that we can fish for a long time. It's the only way it's gonna work. There is no other program like the Fisheries Fund. And in my experience in working, trying to find somebody to help and somebody to work with us, there was nobody. They are the only program that I know of. If it wasn't for them, this doesn't happen for me.
Okay, I'd also like to give voice to four of the borrowers who have shared their story and lending experience about the California Fisheries Fund. First, Michelle Norville, of president of Fort Bragg Groundfish Conservation Trust, says, quote, "For us, it seemed like an impossible dream to have a quota fund in the Fort Bragg community. The cost was high, and there were not a lot of sellers. But when an opportunity to buy quota share was in front of us, California Fisheries Fund proved to be an excellent partner. From beginning to end, CFF made the borrowing process smooth, efficient, and affordable. With two successful years behind us, we are approaching our third year thinking about new opportunities, whether it be investing in much-needed infrastructure, acquiring additional quota share, or developing community programs. It's a good feeling to be in a position to explore opportunities for other investments that benefit our local fishing port, fishing operations, and the community at large," end quote. Kyle Pemberton with fishing vessel Mariah Lee out of Morro Bay and Half Moon Bay says, quote, "A CFF loan gave me the opportunity to buy the boat and start a business. Without it, I wouldn't have the opportunity because banks around here won't lend you the money because they don't support commercial fishing," end quote. Terry Hunt, CEO of Wild Planet Foods, shares, quote, "As a direct beneficiary of a CFF loan, Wild Planet Foods has grown to become a successful and unique supplier of sustainable seafood in both the packaged seafood category and as an exporter of live fresh seafood. When looking to fund the expansion of our production and shipping capabilities with $3 million in bank facilities, we teamed up with a consortium of lenders and CFF took the lead in providing a loan to fund our capital expenditures. This build-out of infrastructure has not only enabled Wild Planet to support the fishing communities that supply our sustainably sourced seafood, it has also provided for additional warehousing jobs for 20 individuals. Working with CFF has facilitated Wild Planet's aggressive growth," end quote. And lastly, Evan Jones with fishing vessel Zeal out of Ventura says, quote, "The biggest thing we're thankful for is the loan gave us the chance to get in the game, and it gave us the ability to grow. Without the loan, we couldn't have done it. Most of our fishing is direct to consumer now, and we're fishing for high-value fish. We don't have to catch as much. It's enough profitability that I can catch what I need for the weekend, and I don't even fill half my quota. We're trying to be good stewards of what we're given, and we've done a good job of it," end quote. OPC staff recommends transferring administration of its contribution from Environmental Defense Fund to the Northern California Community Loan Fund. Environmental Defense Fund, an environmental nonprofit, has been the administrator of the fund since its inception. However, due to an evolved strategic plan and lack of long-term in-house lending infrastructure, they seek to transfer administrative duties. The Northern California Community Loan Fund, or NCCLF, was identified after a year-long thorough and strategic search for an appropriate administrative entity. They are a community development financial institution whose mission is to promote economic justice and alleviate poverty by increasing the financial resilience and sustainability of community-based nonprofits and enterprises. NCCLF has demonstrated experience in administering successful loan programs and has overall mission alignment with the intent of the Fisheries Fund. Should the council approve this transfer to NCCLF, OPC's contribution will support loan applicants statewide, and OPC will continue to have an advisory role to oversee mission-based objectives of the loans. There will be a structural update to the administration in order to leverage additional funds. OPC will require a 3-to-1 leverage of other lenders to OPC's contribution and will operate with a 25% top loss reserve position. This means that should there be a loss, OPC's contribution would take the first loss up to 25% of the overall loan amount. This is a risk, but it is a small risk based on the past 9 years of successful lending, in which there was only a partial loss from one borrower of about $43,000. This structure will enable OPC to do more with less, increasing the impact of OPC's investment by leveraging additional funds to support commercial fisheries that achieve environmental conservation, improved profitability for the industry, and stability for port communities. This is also a similar structure to the Golden State Acquisition Fund, which is another state bond-supported revolving loan fund. OPC funds currently invested in the portfolio will only meet this leverage requirement once they have been repaid and recycled into new loans. The start date would be soon after this council meeting in 2018 should this transfer be approved. OPC and NCCLF staff recommend a 3-year check-in point at which to assess if the transfer was successful and mutually beneficial. This would allow NCCLF to originate loans for 3 years until 2021. Because loan terms range from 1 to 10 years, an associated up to 10-year payback period results in a termination date of 2031. The CFF is a unique model. California does not have any other similar fisheries loan programs. There are impact investment sources. However, there are not revolving loan funds that support commercial fisheries in California. CFF loans strive to support a positive environmental, social, and financial impact, and OPC's initial investment has a proven track record of fostering sustainable fisheries in California. Therefore, OPC staff recommends this reauthorization and transfer of administration to NCCLF. I'm happy to answer any questions at this time, and I'd also like to indicate that we have Phoebe Higgins, who is the director of the California Fisheries Fund, in attendance, as well as Nate Schaffrin, who's a senior loan officer at NCCLF. Thank you.
Thank you. I have no requests to speak on this, so we could go to any questions or action. Then I'll make a brief comment. I thought it was a great presentation. It covered it completely, and we should do it. So do we have a motion? Motion by Michael Brown, second by Matt Rodriguez. Yes, you noted exactly the recommended action, so I know that's what the motion is. So any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries unanimously. Thank you very much, and thanks for the people that were waiting just in case we had a question. We will move to item number 8, informational item, update on MPA Collaborative Network, MOU, and Small Grants Program.
Good afternoon, Council members. My name is Tova Handelman. I'm a California Sea Grant Fellow at the Ocean Protection Council, and I am happy to present an update to you today about OPC's first ever Small Grants Program with the MPA Collaborative Network. We have 4 guest speakers here today representing collaboratives from across the state, and they are going to give you a sneak peek at the wonderful projects that they are working on to advance outreach and education about marine protected areas. But first, I'll give you a brief overview of what the MPA Collaborative Network is and what has happened over the past year. The MPA Collaborative Network is made up of 14 collaboratives associated with coastal counties across the state. The collaboratives provide a forum for nonprofits, tribal representatives, scientists, members of the fishing community, and other local experts to work together to enhance MPA stewardship in their region. Over the past few years, a meaningful partnership has developed between the state and the Collaborative Network to further inform and support the adaptive management of MPAs statewide. At the council meeting in October of 2016, the council approved funding to take 2 important steps to further that partnership. The first was to convene a workshop to develop and execute a memorandum of understanding between the Collaborative Network and the MPA statewide leadership team
which is made up of agencies with authority, mandates, or interests that relate to California's marine protected areas. Our partner, Coastal Quest, guided the participants to identify shared goals for coordination among these partners in the management of MPAs. And we now have a memorandum of understanding that formalizes the partnership between the state and the collaborative network, and it recognizes the significant contributions the collaboratives have made in advancing MPA management. With the MOU in place, the next important step was to fund a collaborative network small grants program for projects that would improve compliance, stewardship, and understanding of marine protected areas at the local level, and would also continue to inform the state's approach to adaptively manage MPAs to ensure their success. At the two-day workshop to develop the MOU, the group created a shared statement to collectively manage California's MPA network in accordance with the Marine Life Protection Act by integrating diverse local and statewide perspectives and expertise. It is really important to all the parties involved that there is information sharing and transparency between the state and local organizations, and the dedication to this unique relationship can be seen when all the participating agencies and organizations signed or endorsed the MOU with full support, and there is a copy of the MOU in your binder for you to review. The Small Grants Program has gotten off to an exciting start, with all 14 collaboratives submitting proposals for projects that range from children's activity books, educational brochures on fishing regulations within MPA boundaries, MPA educational events, and citizen science programs. Some projects incorporate the knowledge and leaderships of local tribes, and many projects have multilingual components. The proposals were reviewed by a committee made up of different agency expertise, and I am happy to announce that all 14 collaboratives received grants of $15,000 each. Some collaboratives took the opportunity to work together to share financial resources, volunteer time, and ultimately the finished products that will come from their projects. And several projects from other collaboratives have strong potential to be shared widely beyond their individual counties and further their impact along the coast. The grants are for 1 year, and all of the projects are expected to be completed by February 2019. And I'd like to thank Coastal Quest for their help in the coordination and administration of the grants. And now it is my great pleasure to turn it over to our guest speakers. We have four collaborative co-chairs from different regions of the state here to share more information about the awesome projects that they are working on. I wish we had enough time to highlight all of the projects from the collaboratives across the state, but there's a short summary in your binder if you'd like to take a look at that. And I'll let them introduce themselves, so we'll start with Bill.
Thank you, Tova. Mr. Secretary and members of the Council, good afternoon. Thank you for allowing me to give you a snapshot. I'm Bill Lemus of Mendocino and our collaborative, co-chaired by Anna Newman of ReefCheck and Theo Whitehurst, are very pleased that we have the funding now to go ahead and engage with the community. It's just thanks to you and the OPC staff that we now have some work to do that can get us into the public eye. We have created, through our tabling and meeting of people, and if you go to the second slide, you'll see our new brochure that has just come out. I was hoping to have some here today, but they didn't show up at my hotel room, but they're probably there now. But you'll see in other slides from the other co-chairs are a lot of people doing things, but what we have is a very small, dedicated group of people. And you'll see from the photographs of our beautiful coastline, we may be short on numbers. What we have are big coastlines with big vistas and beautiful MPAs, and we're very proud of the work that we're doing there. We've also partnered with ReefCheck, NRDC, and the new NOIO Center for Marine Science with Sheila Siemens, who has articulated the world's most incredible orca skeleton that's now on display that will be in her new marine laboratory on the NOIO Headlands. And so we've got a lot going on. She's also working on a project to it's as bad as you think up there. It really is. Our beaches are awash in young, juvenile and adult abalone shells. She's got a project to remove urchins, and she has divers, urchin divers, actively removing urchins from the bottom of the ocean to try to see how we're going to get kelp to come back and monitoring it. She's got a great project, and we're working with her on how to get that into the community to bring back some of the excitement that people bring to the coast when it's abalone season. Now it's urchin eradication season, and we're going to do what we can to see in a scientific way how we're going to process these things and see if the kelp will come back, and then, of course, the other animals come back with it. I'd also like to thank the council for your vote to take the resolution to the oil hearing stage to this federal government and let them know that, as Mr. Secretary, you took me down memory lane there back in 1988, 30 years ago next month. I had the honor of being the last speaker at the oil hearings for lease sale 91. And Rachel Bina had schooled us really well. Talk as long as you want. And so, being the last speaker, and it was late into the second day, like you said, I had spoken eloquently for 25 minutes, and I was just at the crescendo of my speech when I was going to say, and I did say it, I will lay down my life to protect Big River where I grew up, which is now a marine protected area. And I looked up at the Minerals Management Service staff up there, and three of them were sound asleep. So thank you very much for your attention. I'm glad you're staying awake.
I think that was part of Rachel's goal.
Thank you so much for all you're doing. We're really happy that you've got our backs, and you've got the support of the community, too.
Thank you for being here today.
Hi, good afternoon, Secretary and Council members. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak today, and thank you for your continued support of the MPA Collaborative Network, especially through this new small grants program. My name is Rebecca Johnson. I'm the co-chair of the San Mateo MPA Collaborative. I also co-direct citizen science at the California Academy of Sciences. Our collaborative is made up of a diverse group of folks from local to state, federal agencies, scientists, educators, nonprofits, and law enforcement. We've worked on a number of projects together. Most notably, maybe, is the first MPA collaborative harbor kiosk in the harbor in Half Moon Bay that you saw a picture of earlier. We have three MPAs in San Mateo and one large state marine reserve that includes over 3 miles of rocky intertidal habitat. That's just about 20 minutes from SFO. So this location, you can see it here, is visited by over 200,000 people every year from across the Bay Area and across the world. Many of them come because of word of mouth or they read about this place in guidebooks. We see this as a great opportunity for engagement about our amazing biodiversity and also about MPAs. Our partners have had success with video projects in the past, and we have a significant video production expertise skills on our team. And so with this small grant, our collaborative will work together with a new community advisory board made up of folks not traditionally a part of MPA education and outreach. And together, we'll develop a series of culturally relevant messages and then translate these messages into videos for sharing and distribution across diverse media in a coordinated multilingual campaign. We're confident that our efforts will build a more diverse group of MPA stewards and champions that is more reflective of our community and lead to a better understanding and appreciation of how the California MPA network functions to sustain our coast for everyone into the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Hello.
Who do you work for?
I was gonna have you guess. My name is Carl Bryan, and I'm one of the co-chairs for the San Luis Obispo Marine Protected Area Collaborative. We're made up of 95 members working on enforcement and compliance, research and monitoring, and education for the San Luis Obispo Coast MPAs. And two of our best-known MPAs are Morro Bay, and we also have Piedras Blancas Northern Elephant Seal Colony. We're really lucky to call that one of our MPAs. the members from local tribes, agencies, Morro Bay National Estuary Program, we have Cal Poly, we have Cuesta representatives, fishing clubs and organizations, two of them, businesses and aquariums, give input, BioBlitz, share resources, and work on MPA-related issues. We have a lot of enthusiasm, and we have a lot of fun working together. A dedicated small working group used our first grant to create two videos, shows for visitors in hotel rooms throughout the county, along the coast, and also in the regional airport. And they highlight MPAs, what they are, how they benefit people and wildlife, and what you can do in them. The San Luis Obispo Marine Protected Area Collaborative would like to thank the Ocean Protection Council for providing the funding that made the videos possible and for funding the next small grant project. The Collaborative voted to use the second small grant to create and launch the California Coastal MPA Kids Activity Booklet to share across MPA collaboratives up and down the coast. It will be a downloadable and printed booklet that incorporates existing MPA children's lessons plans, models, and California Department of Fish and Wildlife MPA messaging into a fun and innovative educational resource. Children, parents, teachers, and educators will be excited to use it either as a standalone resource or during presented programs. The booklet features activities, open-ended reflections that put the child in the role of MPA advocate. The booklet has simple at-home experiments, interactive pages, all the favorite things that you used to do in the doctor's office, you know, when you had to find things and count things. And so they'll be learning about coastwide issues, including respecting wildlife, climate change, citizen science, and marine debris, allowing children to explore their relationship to MPAs, whether they're at home, in an urban area, at an inland school, or are visiting an MPA. The Collaborative is excited to have the opportunity to create this MPA product for children. I think we're all a bunch of children ourselves, and we know that that's really important. And we want to thank you for your support of the San Luis Obispo Marine Protected Area Collaborative and the MPA Network. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
It's hard to follow uniform badge personnel, but I managed not to stain my white shirt on my flight up this morning. So, good afternoon, council members and staff. I'm Zachary Plopper, Conservation Director at Wild Coast and co-chair of the San Diego County MPA Community Collaborative. First and foremost, I want to thank you for your support to the California Collaborative Network and to these great projects that we're looking at today, and really helping to make California's MPA network a global model for stakeholder-driven marine conservation and management. The San Diego Collaborative is comprised of over 120 representatives from more than 60 different local, state, federal agencies, tribes, researchers, user groups, legal experts, fishermen, all sorts of coastal stakeholders. And one of the greatest needs that we've identified in our region is how do you provide effective outreach to a broad and diverse public audience before they get to our marine protected areas? And that includes student groups that visit the MPAs during field trips. It includes out-of-towners, the millions of visitors that come to San Diego County beaches and wetlands every year, and even local residents that still don't know that they visit a marine protected area every single day. So along with some other collaborators in the state, we decided that we would develop these outreach toolkits with the goals of enhancing MPA compliance, appreciation, and stewardship. And so these toolkits are going to include a standardized curriculum that we're working with the other collaborators across the state to develop so we can tap into resources that already exist and then ensure consistent messaging across the state. And then also printed materials such as fish guides, recreational brochures, posters, some materials that already exist, and then some new materials as you see here. These are our San Diego County Recreation and Wildlife Guides. On the opposite side of this will be a beautiful illustrated display of wildlife that's common to our San Diego County Marine Protected Areas. This is actually modeled on guides that Wild Coast helped develop for the Cabo Pulmo National Park in Mexico, which is one of the world's most successful marine protected areas. So we're really excited to be able to translate this through the collaborative to San Diego County's MPAs, potentially other regions in the county. So thanks again for your support. I really look forward to updating you as the year goes on these projects, and we think it's going to be a very impactful 2018 for California's Marine Protected Area Network. Thanks.
Thank you. And all four of you traveled a bit, so thank you for being here.
Yes, I would like to end by thanking Secretary Laird and the Council for your continued support of this partnership with the Collaborative Network. I'd also like to thank Collaborative Network Director Calla Allison and her staff for all the coordination they do to balance the collaboratives and the state's needs. And I would especially like to thank our four collaborative co-chairs who took time to come here today and all of the collaborative members across the state who volunteer countless hours of their time because they truly care that their local marine protected areas are being managed successfully. This partnership exemplifies our novel approach to MPA management and is providing a global example of how to make MPAs work. So thank you for your attention, and I'd be happy to answer any questions, or our co-chairs would be happy to answer questions as well.
I do have two people that have requested to speak. The first one is Jocelyn Herbert from the Resources Legacy Fund, and the second one is Calla Allison from the MBA Collaborative Network, who will thank you for her thanks when she gets a chance there.
Good afternoon, Secretary Laird, members of the Council. Jocelyn Herbert with Resources Legacy Fund. Just want to echo thanks to the Council for supporting strong local stewardship of State Marine Protected Area Network through both the MOU that Tova described as well as the small grants program that you just heard about. Durable local stewardship of marine protected areas has been and remains a priority of the philanthropic foundations that have been working in partnership with the state these many years to establish and implement California's marine protected areas. So, the support of this council has really been instrumental in helping to grow and establish the collaborative network itself and to strengthen local stewardship, as we just heard from Tova and from the four co-chairs who traveled to be here with us today in Sacramento. So just want to express our appreciation and gratitude from Resources Legacy Fund for the leadership and good work on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for all the philanthropic effort toward this.
Good afternoon, Secretary and Council members and staff. And I just want to say thank you. Oh, Calla Allison, I'm the director of the Marine Protected Area Collaborative Network. So I'll throw in a third thank you for the great support you guys have given to the collaboratives. I'm so proud just listening to all the great stuff they're doing. And these are four of the collaboratives. There's another 10 that are also doing incredible work. And a lot of stuff's coming up that has statewide implication as well, one of which is that teacher toolkit you heard a little bit about, which I have to say, as the person that got, somehow ended up with being in charge of MPA education for my son's science night, cannot be developed quick enough. So I'm really looking forward to the curriculum that they come up with and the activities. And it's just a great, great network. And we really appreciate the support that you continue to give to the collaboratives and to the collaborative network. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there comments or questions? Then... Oh, go ahead, Michael.
This really is amazing work, and it's great to hear the four stories, and I'm just kind of blown away with what you guys are coming up with. And I want to thank all the collaboratives for exploring new areas, new audiences, and whatever, and especially for reaching out to folks in the communities for whom the MPAs are a mystery, and whether that's kids or non-native English speakers, it's just great to see the effort to broaden the connection between all of California's population with the marine protected areas. It's really good. Thank you.
Thank you. And let me just make a couple of comments first, because I know how far you all came today. And I have this, Mark knows him, he might not say this, a very tolerant spouse, but when we stopped at Bowling Ball Beach, Point Arena Lighthouse and the 10 Mile Beach to take pictures of the signs because I was so excited. He sort of lost his patience for like the multiple stops, and it just showed me, and I was also at Piedras Blancas in the last year, it showed me the work that has been done. And as much as we try to do the policy leadership and really set it, it takes the collaboratives to sort of help bring people together on the ground to do some of the education and outreach that doesn't traditionally come from a more traditional government agency. And so it just drives it that next level that really makes it possible. So we are incredibly grateful for your work and incredibly grateful when we can see it, which we can. And so it is really good, and just appreciate it, whether it's traveling up here or working with other people, or even if you have to do a kid's science class presentation to make it happen. That's where the change comes from, and that's where people take it in. And after a while, people wonder why it was ever a question. But this is what's getting it there, so thank you. Any other comments on this while we're on this item? And thanks, everybody, for that. We'll move to our last item, which is public comment on non-agenda items, and I have two. Jason Giffen from the Port of San Diego, and then Richard E.T. Sadowski on deck.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Secretary Laird, members of the Council, staff. My name is Jason Giffen. I'm here on behalf of the Port of San Diego. First off, I'd just like to start by saying thanks very much to the council and staff for taking a little bit more time, and I'll say a little bit more time, Secretary Laird, on receiving outreach and input on the council's sea level rise guidance. Created by the San Diego Unified Port District in 1962, the Port of San Diego is a unique and diverse area, both in terms of geography and uses. As a grantee of title and submerged lands of San Diego Bay, the port has a mission to protect and promote public trust doctrine uses, including commerce, navigation, fisheries, recreation, and environmental stewardship. These public trust uses are spread across a mixed-use bay with an urban dense waterfront to the north, a working waterfront in the center, and more open space and conservation areas to the south. To balance these different uses, the Port of San Diego has been taking an active leadership role in innovation to strategically plan for and manage these uses. To this end, the Port has been a leader on several important planning and environmental issues over the past few years. The Port of San Diego was among the first ports in the nation to voluntarily adopt a climate action plan to achieve greater greenhouse gas reductions. The Port and the U.S. Navy partnered on a bay-wide effort to update the Integrated Natural Resource Management Plan, a collaborative ecosystem-based approach to protect, conserve, and restore sensitive and native species and habitats like eelgrass for the entire San Diego Bay, and we're grateful for the support the San Diego Bay region has received from OPC and will continue to receive in the future. Additionally, we began our Port Master Plan update, which will include policy guidance intended to increase coastal resiliency and coastal-dependent and coastal-related uses and reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And more recently, in response to AB 691 requirements and as a part of our Port Master Plan update, we've initiated an action plan to address sea level rise. As a result, the release of the OPC Sea Level Rise Guidance Update, in addition to being greatly appreciated, is very timely. We want to thank OPC staff for the workshop held in San Diego on June 12, 2017, to solicit local stakeholder input. As stakeholders, we appreciate the opportunity to continually engage with you on these important issues. We also appreciate the opportunity to provide comment on the latest guidance. We did submit a formal comment letter to acknowledge the unique characteristics of ports and coastal-dependent resources, and importantly, promote future coordinated planning efforts with ports to address vulnerabilities and response strategies. We're looking forward to participating in the upcoming webinars to learn more about changes to the guidance and how they will ultimately play out. Working together with State Lands, as an example, we collaborated with California Coastal Commission on their sea level rise guidance in 2015, and we're enthusiastic about continuing this work, and we strongly believe through open dialogue we can together resolve outstanding issues and open doors for future collaboration to ensure ports continue to thrive and submerged tidelands and uplands remain vibrant. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your comments, for being here today. And Richard Sadowski.
I'm really proud to be a native Californian, and especially in these times and the work that all you guys and your great staff is doing on sea level rise and climate change and taking it seriously and an adaptation. I want to talk about the, you know, importance of having the right people for the job too. When I was back in the 80s, I was really blessed with being in a position. I was a test operations engineer for a man that I hold high esteem, and that's Dr. Darrell W. Pepper. He's the foremost authority on hypersonic fluid dynamics. I was testing scramjets for him. And I remember him visiting the test cell, and one of the things that I felt from him is that the importance of everybody there, regardless of their background. I had mechanics that came from biker shops. I had machinists from biker shops. I had welders from the welding, from oil industry, technicians that were just coming from the Air Force. I had high school dropouts that just got their girlfriend pregnant, you know, but they were there on the front line there. And recognizing having the right people for the right job. And one of the things is that, you know, you mentioned Peter Douglas from the Coastal Commission. And the other people that were there back in Prop 20, back in 1970, in the early 70s, getting that on the ballot, developing the Coastal Commission, those are people like my wife. She was out there canvassing San Clemente and San Diego area. And we come here to the OPC because we see hope in getting things done. And I just want to thank you guys for being here and giving us hope. Thanks.
Thank you. We really appreciate your comments, and that's a great note on which to get to the end of the meeting. And I would just note, because it was referred to by the gentleman from the Port of San Diego, we will be having a meeting on March 14th, 3 to 5 p.m. It'll be at the Energy Commission. If some of you are remote, there's a chance we can announce remote locations. But basically, the sea level rise guidance wasn't quite ready for this meeting, and it made me crazy to think we would wait for 3 or 3.5 months to the next one. So this is being scheduled specifically for that, to give that extra time to incorporate the concerns that are being expressed and do some additional public outreach, but then adopt it once we think it's been vetted in a form. So the next meeting will be March 14th. With that, thank you all for sticking all the way with this, and for many of you who traveled a long distance, we will stand adjourned.